Do keep Mark chapter 5 open in front of you. Every day we touch other people. How many? Dozens? If you commute to the city each day or take public transport, you probably touch hundreds of people. But there are different kinds of touches. The inadvertent touches are meaningless. You might apologize if you accidentally bump someone. Otherwise, you don't even think of all the unintentional contact you have with other human beings. The small touch as you exchange money, as you purchase your lunch. The brief touch as you pass someone by. Can you remember the first time you touched your wife or husband? You probably touched them 50 times before you actually touched them. But none of those counted. But the first time you actually touched them with intent, you took their hand and you held it, and they held yours back, you felt something. Or the first time you touched your child, holding them in your arms and you stroking their cheek, feeling how soft their skin is, you felt something. When you love someone, you touch them. And yet not all touch is good. There's another kind of touch that is purposeful and intended to harm. If you've been cruelly hit by someone who is supposed to love you, something happened in that touch. You were shamed. If you were touched sexually by someone you didn't want to touch you, you would discover one of the laws of intentional touch. It lingers much longer than the physical act. In fact, it cannot be broken apart from a good touch that erases and replaces the old. Scripture is all about touch, though you might not see that on an initial reading. In the Old Testament, touch can seem very confusing. Some of it can be very good. So, for example, if you are a priest and you touch the consecrated altar, the holiness rubbed off on you and you were made holy, at least temporarily. Or picture Aaron, the high priest, laying his hands on a scapegoat, an actual live goat, and confessing over it the people's wickedness. And somehow God ordained that in Aaron's purposeful touch, sins would be transferred from the people to another living creature. And that transfer was a great blessing to the people. The goat, not the people, would carry the weight of sin. The touch here was important. In the Old Testament, touch was usually a good thing, but you still had to be careful. When God came to Mount Sinai to meet with his people, they had to ritually wash or consecrate themselves according to God's direction. Even then, if one uninvited person touched the mountain, he or she would be put to death with stones. No one was allowed to touch that person. Years later, when the Ark of God was being moved and when the oxen pulling its cart tumbled, Uzziah instantly reached to steady the sacred object and died immediately. Touch could be a very dangerous thing. Get touched at the wrong time by the wrong person and you at least became unclean. Perhaps even die. Get touched at the right time by the right person and you came to life. The New Testament specializes in good touch. With Jesus, there's a lot of touching going on, and it's all good. In Mark 5, there are two stories sandwiched together. They have a number of similarities. So both stories are of females being healed. The woman's illness and the girl's age are both given as 12 years. In both stories, Jesus is met with rebuke. In both stories, bring Jesus into contact with uncleanliness by touch. In both stories, the woman and the girl transferred their uncleanness to Jesus, and to each, Jesus bestows the cleansing wholeness of God by touch. In faith, both is required, and in both, touch is key. And so first we see faith in Jesus' touch overcomes shame. Faith in Jesus' touch overcomes shame. Jesus has just returned from the region of the Gerasenes. At the moment his boat lands, a large crowd gather around him. But one man, the local synagogue ruler, Jairus, gets in front of Jesus. He falls to his knees. He pleads with Jesus to come with him, to come and heal his dying daughter. And Jesus goes. But on the way, with a large crowd pressing, there is a woman. She is a woman whose name we don't know, whose position we're not told, who in contrast to Jairus is a nobody. But she is a woman who is desperate. She's been subject to bleeding for 12 years. Verse 26 in the Greek is just kind of a volley of participles to underline her desperateness. It just goes, having a blood flow, having suffered from many doctors, having not improved, but having gotten worse. Things were bad. And if the physical nature of her illness was not bad enough, the shame attached to it would have driven anyone to desperate measures. Back then, the Old Testament law prescribed, Leviticus 15, 19 to 27, that a woman was unclean during her menstrual cycle. And anyone who came into contact, touched a woman during her monthly cycle would be banished, declared unclean till evening. So this woman, whose bleeding did not last for a couple of days a month, but every day for 12 years, was unclean. She would have been banished from the temple. She would have been banished from society. And not only was she deemed unclean, but anyone who touched her would become unclean. So she lived in a world where people would have been afraid to touch her, would have to make contact with her. And for 12 years, she's lived with being unclean. She spent every penny she had seeking to be healed. Seeking to become clean, seeking to be accepted, seeking to have her shame removed. And verse 27, she hears of Jesus. And she comes up behind him in the crowd in order to touch his cloak. Thinking to herself, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Now, Mark does not reveal to us why the woman came to think Jesus could heal her this way. It might have been because there was a particular thought in the ancient world that rulers possessed power to bless those who touched them. But I think Jesus' words to her in verse 34 indicate that it was more than that. That she had seen or heard something about Jesus, about the way he healed, about who he might be. Now, she probably did not recognize at this point Jesus as the Son of God, as the Messiah, as Mark has revealed to us in chapter 1, verse 1. But she knew enough. She knew enough to know just a touch of his clothes would heal her. Because this one was possibly a representative of God. And Mark makes no judgment on her doctrine or lack of it. Rather, he relates that she does the one and only important thing for a disciple to do. She heard, she came, she touched. To act on what one hears about Jesus is always, in Mark, the sign of a disciple. And she is immediately healed. Immediately, her bleeding stops. Immediately, she felt in her body, that she was freed from suffering. 12 years of shame and frustration are resolved in a momentary touch of Jesus. But what happened next, she did not expect. For Jesus at once realizes that power had gone out from him. And he begins to look for the person who has touched his clothes. And his disciples rebuke him. Oh, Jesus, you see the people crowding against you, and yet you ask who touched me? Hundreds of people are touching you, Jesus. It's like standing on the platform of London Bridge in rush hour. There are people everywhere. There are people all around you. But Jesus keeps looking. Because he knows there was one touch that was not inadvertent. It wasn't just a mere brushing. It had been a touch that had been meaningful, intentional. It had been an act of faith. And this woman, knowing what had happened to her, comes and falls at his feet and, trembling with fear, tells him the whole truth. This woman who had for 12 years lived with the shame of her illness, who had lived with the shame of being labeled unclean, who had presumably feared the crowd, knowing her illness, knowing her secret, fearing their comments, fearing their abuse, fearing their rejection, has sought not to ask Jesus, but merely touch Jesus, so that others might not know. And so she comes before him now trembling, not only because all will be revealed, but fearing his rebuke. After all, her actions would have made Jesus unclean, and her presence in the crowd would have made many of them unclean. And Jesus meets her fear, meets her shame, not with reproach, not with rebuke, but with tender compassion. Daughter, daughter. This woman has not been addressed as an outsider, but family. Daughter, your faith has healed you. And the word healed here is the same in Greek, same word to save. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. And the woman hears from Jesus' mouth what she's already experienced from his person. See, note the same phrase is used both here and in verse 29. Both times Mark says she was freed from her suffering. Jesus' words interpret her experience. She's been freed because of her faith in Jesus, her faith to touch him. For as God, he can make the unclean clean. That was a picture we saw in the Old Testament. As the priest touches the holy altar, he's made holy. The holy makes the unclean clean. Jesus, as the holy Son of God, rather than becoming unclean, makes her clean. Jesse had touched the leper in chapter 1 and made him clean. Here, as he is touched, he makes the woman clean. And her becoming clean was as important as her being physically healed. With her healing came cleanliness. With cleanliness meant her shame was lifted. She was freed from her suffering, her physical suffering and her social suffering. She's now able to live as part of the community once more. She's able to touch and be touched without fear of making others unclean. Her shame is lifted. Faith in Jesus' touch has overcome her shame. It's possibly why Jesus wanted to speak with her as well. So not only did she hear it from him, but that the crowd would see that this woman was now clean, that she was now able to touch and be touched, that her shame was no longer around her. That not only was she physically healed, but that she was socially healed, as it were. Her shame had been lifted. Her faith in Jesus' touch, has overcome her shame. And that's true not just for her, but for all who come to Jesus. Ed Welch defines shame as the deep sense that you are unacceptable because of something you did, something done to you, or something associated with you. You feel exposed and humiliated. Or, put more strongly, you are disgraced because you acted less than human, you were treated as if you were less than human, or you were associated with something less than human, and there are witnesses. This woman knew shame. She was associated with shame because of her bleeding. And her faith in Jesus, demonstrated by her touch of Jesus, saw that shame lifted. And the reality is that most of us live with shame. That all of us, if we were to pause and think for a moment, could recall something we did, something done to us, something associated with us that brings us shame. Maybe it was some particular sinful act that we did. Maybe it was a harmful word or an horrific act that was said or done to us. Maybe it was something done, a crime or an act by a family member, something our children did that is always associated with us, or we feel is associated with us, and we feel ashamed. Here in the West, shame is not something we really speak about personally or culturally. We don't quite know what to do with shame. But in the East, the Middle East, both in Jesus' day and today, people would understand the impact of shame. To live in shame is a big thing. To shame one's family is a big thing. It's why every now and then, isn't it? Even in the UK, we hear of honour killings. Killing the family member who has brought shame on the family in order to try and restore honour back to the family name. But here in the West, we can't quite grasp what to do with our shame. It's not that we don't experience shame, but rather than talk about it, we bury it, we suppress it. We don't talk about that family member. Or if we do in hushed tones. Or we don't mention that particular episode or period of our life. And then what happens is that every now and then we will hear something, say something, watch something, and it will trigger the shame within us. And depending on our character and the degree of what it is that shames us and how close to the event, etc., will then determine how we respond. For some, it will be a momentary pang of guilt. For others, it will spin them for a period. For others, it will leave them feeling unclean and dirty. For others, it might cause them to become depressed and withdraw. For nearly all, it will make us feel that if people really knew us, knew that thing we were hiding, that thing we did or done to us or associated with us, well, then no one would speak with us. No one would be our friend. No one would hang out with us. We'd be like that woman. No one would want to touch us for fear of being made unclean. And the emotions and that pang of guilt and the sense of spinning, and that sense of uncleanliness and the depression and the withdrawing all comes because we've not learnt to deal with our shame. We don't quite know what to do with it, but suppress it or bury it. But the gospel is that we have a God who touches us, and in touching us, makes us clean. Both from our sin and from our shame. You see, when Mark recalls that Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, that word power is a loaded term. If you search the scriptures for its meaning, you would see it included the idea of holiness being conferred, forgiveness of sins, cleansing and purification, healing, identification with Jesus' status. So as that woman, as we touch Jesus by faith, he confers on us, he gives us his holiness, his forgiveness, his cleansing, his healing, his standing. We become like him. And he takes from us the unclean person, our sins, our shameful acts, our victimization and its contamination, our disease, and he makes us clean. He restores us. He makes us human. He gives us dignity. That is the gospel. The gospel means that by faith in Jesus, I become one with Jesus. I share his standing. I share all the benefits he has. I become a child of God. I am one in Christ. I am one who is a son or a daughter. I am one who is clean and forgiven and holy and able to stand before the very throne of God himself. And when we grasp that, when we allow that to penetrate and infiltrate our minds and our hearts, can you see if that is who I am? I'm no longer defined by what I did, what have been done to me, or what is associated to me. My shame is removed because I have a God who comes and touches and makes me clean. Which means that in truth, I can be open about what shames me. I can talk about it. Now, that's not to say we go and share all with all. No, it must be done appropriately, but I don't need to hide. If the Son of God knows all there is about me and has accepted me and made me clean and removed my shame, that I may stand before him in all his holiness, I can stand as a child of God. What does it matter what you think of me? I've been freed from my suffering. I mean, think about that woman standing before that crowd. And she hears Jesus' words, daughter, freed from suffering. Do you think she cared what the crowd thought about her at that moment? Do you think she went home and hid? I can't go out. If I start telling people I'm healed and I can touch people, then they'll want to know what was wrong with me, and I can't mention the last 12 years. Do you think that's what she did? I don't think so. I think she would have gone and told people about the one who had not only healed her, but who had removed her shame and restored her dignity and made her human. And that's the gospel, isn't it? You have faith in Jesus to do that, to overcome your shame, to give you your dignity, to make you human. Faith in Jesus' touch overcomes shame. And secondly, faith in Jesus' touch overcomes death. Now the good news is that my points aren't weighted, so they're not equally length. Otherwise we'll be here till 8 o'clock. But the second point is this. Jesus' touch overcomes death. Now Jesus had been on his way to Jairus' dying daughter. And as Jesus is speaking to this woman, some men come from the house of Jairus and say to him, verse 35, your daughter is dead, why bother the teacher anymore? And the interruption, so profitable to the woman, has cost the life of Jairus' daughter. But hope is not lost. Verse 36, ignoring, literally, that is, paying no attention to it, refusing to listen to it, discounting the truth of it. Jesus tells the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid, just believe. Jairus is to believe. And he's to do so in the context of just witnessing true believing faith. The woman is the model. She's the example of faith. Jairus is to follow her example. Here's the challenge before him. He is not to be afraid, but to believe. And there is only one thing Jairus can do. He must shift his focus from the circumstances of his daughter's death to Jesus himself. To believe either only in what the circumstances allow, his little girl is dead, or to believe in the God who makes all things possible. One thing is necessary, to believe, to have faith. And Jesus, not allowing anyone to follow apart from Peter, James and John, sets off. When they arrive at Jairus' house, they're met with a commotion. They're met with crying and wailing. And Jesus goes in, he says to them all, why all this commotion and wailing? This child's not dead, but asleep. And hearing this, like the disciples rebuking him for asking who had touched him, the crowd laugh and mock him and rebuke him. Now Jesus is not saying that this girl did not die. He's merely making a metaphor, an indication that things are not quite over. And so he kicks them all out, and he takes the three disciples, and he takes the girl's mother, and he takes the girl's father, and he goes into her room. And verse 41, he takes her by the hand, he touches her, just as Jairus had asked for in verse 23, please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and lived. And so Jesus, holding her hand, speaks two words to her. Talitha kum. Little girl, I say to you, get up. And immediately, the girl stood up and walked around. And once again, Jesus, who is holy, touches that which is unclean, a dead body. The law is very specific. Leviticus 22, verse 4, to touch a dead body made one unclean. And once more, Jesus' touch makes that which is unclean clean again. But not only does he make the unclean clean, he takes that which is dead and gives life. Jesus is doing the very thing only God can do. He's raising the dead. And up till now in the Bible, only Elijah and Elisha have ever raised someone from the dead. And neither did so in their own authority. Both did so through persistent prayer, by calling out to God. In other words, not in their own authority. But here we see Jesus with a touch raise a dead girl to life. And Mark wants us to think, this one is God. This one is the Son of God. This one is the Christ. This is the one I revealed in Mark 1, verse 1. This is the one. And Mark also wants us to think, you know what? Jairus was right. Jairus was right to believe. Jairus was right to put his faith in this one who with a touch makes unclean clean and the dead alive. So like Jairus, there's only one thing we can do, isn't there? There's only one thing we can do in the face of death, in the face of our greatest threat, our greatest opponent. All we can do, like Jairus, is shift our focus from the circumstances, we will all die, and shift them to Jesus himself. See, we can either believe in what the circumstances allow, that is, we will all die. Fact. Every single person in this room will die. Happy New Year. And when we die, we'll either be buried or cremated. And purely by looking at and observing the circumstances from what we can know as mere humans, you'd have to conclude that if we die, or when we die, more to the point, we are buried and that is it. Or you can shift your focus from yourself, from the view of humanity, and look to the one who has broken into our world and believe. Believe in the God who makes all things possible, who can raise the dead and give them life. In one sense, there's only ever two choices, isn't there? You can listen to ourselves and we can believe in that and what we can see and what we can understand, or you can listen to Jesus and believe in him. And Jesus says only one thing is necessary, to believe, to have faith. And if one has faith, one can obey the command to not be afraid, to face death fearless. It doesn't mean we will not be filled with sorrow as we meet death. But that's different to fear. Fear of what is to come. Fear of losing life. See, by believing in Jesus, one cannot be afraid. Now, none of us know what this year will hold. None of us will know if this is the year the Lord will call me home. None of us know that. But belief in Jesus will mean we can live this year not fearing death. Because by touching Jesus by faith, we can have utter assurance that he will make the unclean clean and make the dead live. Because he says, get up. And he has the touch and the power to give life to the dead. So if you believe in Jesus, there's no need to fear death. See, when in faith we reach out and touch Jesus, what happens? What happens in these accounts? An unclean woman is filled with hope. Fearful father is given faith to believe and witnesses his daughter restored to him. When the woman and Jairus saw Jesus, they felt compelled to touch him, to call him, because they understood in him was salvation. They understood in him was hope, that there is nowhere else to place our faith, that there is no one better to touch. Who will you cry out to? See, the gospel is of a God who touches, who enables us to overcome our shame and overcome our greatest fear, death. That's a gospel worth believing. What will you shift your focus to? What you can see, or to Jesus? Who will you touch in faith?